It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Bickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, an anthropologist shares lessons on happiness from around the world.
First, we're digging deeper into President Obama's plan to make broadband internet more accessible to all Americans. Last week, he outlined the plan, which includes boosting community broadband networks and spending federal money to expand access to rural communities.
Susan Crawford is here to explain the president's plan and why she thinks it's necessary. She's a professor at the Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law, former special assistant to President Obama for science, technology, and innovation, and she's the author of Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, I'm very glad to be here.
So President Obama hit the road, pushing this plan to boost community broadband networks around the country. What did you think of what he had to say?
This was a very moving moment. This was really the president at his best, talking about an initiative which is really not about technology. It's about creating a very large middle class in America that has optimism and choice and freedom. He's couching it in terms of high-speed internet access, but this has become a utility for everybody, and yet so many Americans are left out. All of us are paying too much for second-class service. And the president is suggesting that it makes sense for mayors to take matters into their own hands and make sure that they have world-class internet access where they are. It's a very exciting moment.
Well, connect the dots a little more in-depth for us. Why does high-speed broadband access lead to a stronger middle class, more freedom, the other things you just listed?
Well, think about what effect having electricity had on people around America or the railroad. This is a development like that. This is a basic substrate, a basic sidewalk for everything an American needs to do, everything from getting a world-class education to getting access to the best health care to finding new ways of making a living to creating new jobs for other Americans. Having this issue fixed, making sure that everybody has terrific, inexpensive access, lowers the barriers to all of those things for all Americans, not just for the rich ones. And the president deeply understands this. This really was an FDR moment for President Obama, and he was loose and enthusiastic and cheerful. It was great to see.
Well, a lot of the focus on providing things like municipal service or government-provided community service to high-speed broadband service, why is that important as opposed to the current private sector providers?
Well, as the president made clear, for 3 out of 4 Americans who have access to speeds of 25 megabits per second or greater, so for 3 of the 4 Americans who can actually buy somewhat modern high-speed internet access speeds, they have only one choice, and that choice is their local cable monopoly. And then 40% of Americans can't buy those speeds at any price. So we've got a completely broken market for high-speed internet access in America. And this has happened because of policy, not by accident. And the president is saying that one very good route towards fixing this is installing alternative fiber networks. They don't have to be owned by a city, but they can be called for by a city, or really any village or town. It doesn't have to be a city. And the president wants to lower the barriers to those networks around the country. He's taking a number of steps towards that direction.
Now, a lot of people might be thinking, okay, my internet service that hooks up to my desktop or laptop at home isn't high speed, but, you know, I've got my phone, I've got 4G, I can keep up with what I need to. Why this particular technology? Why is that so important?
Well, Henry Ford has this famous quote, I don't know if he actually said it or not, but that if you asked people what they wanted, they would have said faster horses. So our imagination is limited by what we're able to do right now. People in other countries take this kind of ubiquitous, unlimited, high-capacity, cheap internet access for granted. And Americans, with their pluck and ingenuity and ability to take risks, are going to be inventing all kinds of new things using this access. It's like opening a window. Right now, internet access is something that we have to think about. You know, it's expensive. The circles spin, the wheels spin on our screens as we're trying to do things. What if there was no limitation imposed by internet access, but it was just there, just like light or electricity or clean water. Imagine all the things Americans could do with that. That's what we're talking about.
When you mentioned the current state of policy, the president is calling for the FCC to step in here, but that comes into conflict with some state laws around the country preventing exactly the sort of community-run or community-called-for broadband you're talking about. How does that get untangled?
Well, the president was very straightforward about that. He said, look, in 19 states, vested interests, incumbents who already have a great status quo on their side, they're making tons of money, have rammed through laws through the state legislatures that prohibit cities from making this choice for themselves. He's saying, look, cities should at least have the ability to make that choice, and the FCC has it within its power to preempt, to block the effect of those state laws so that cities can make the choice. He's encouraging the FCC to take that step. He's doing a number of other things, too. He's making available a lot of information through the Department of Commerce about how to build a fiber network in a town. He's also making sure that the loan program run by the Department of Agriculture keeps going. And perhaps most importantly, he's going to call on all of the federal agencies to remove idiotic regulations that get in the way of putting in fiber in places like, you know, next to freeways where the Department of Transportation makes it very difficult, or the EPA has a bunch of idiotic rules. He's forcing those changes through in the next 6 months. So it's quite a bundle of suggestions that are going to be made in the State of the Union and the president will make good on.
Michael Powell has responded. He's a cable industry lobbyist, formerly with the FCC himself. He said, you know, some government-run broadband networks have ended up as costly failures. Is that a concern?
There are about 400 of these networks in the United States. There have been isolated networks that have struggled. That's in the past. Current network operators and managers have learned from those issues, and everybody's getting better at it. And where planning is carried out carefully and well, these networks do extremely well, particularly if they start off with saving the city money on access between municipal buildings and then gradually using the money saved, because you're not paying, you know, a private company, you're doing it for yourself, and plowing that money back into serving businesses by providing cheap fiber. That makes a lot of sense for cities across the country and has been extremely successful. Now they're starting to expand to fiber to the home. So Michael Powell used to be the FCC chairman. He's the guy who deregulated this entire segment, and now he's working for the cable industry, and he likes the world the way it is. He doesn't want to see any change, but Americans are fed up, and that's what the president has seized on.
You've mentioned cities and rural areas. Are those the ones that seem to have the hardest time getting the higher-speed internet access?
Yes. Well, we've got a lot of problems in America. Let's start with cities. In some of America's greatest cities, Detroit, Cleveland, even New York City, as much as 40% of the people living in those cities don't have a wired home, and it's very tightly correlated with socioeconomic status. Rural communities have a horrible time getting adequate internet access, much less world-class access. Other countries like Sweden and Japan and cities like Hong Kong have solved this, and China is saying they're going to bring fiber to 200 million of their residents' homes in the next year. So America needs to catch up, and the president is saying, let's address the gaps in cities and in rural areas and encourage mayors and city leaders and cooperatives across the country to help themselves rather than waiting for the incumbents to decide it's in their interest to bring cheap, ubiquitous access. If we have to wait, this will never happen.
One of the arguments over internet access is the idea, and you've alluded to this, of treating it as a public utility. Late last year, President Obama seems like he's moving in that direction, asking the FCC to treat broadband like other public utilities. How does that all tie in to what we're hearing this last week?
Well, it's all part of the same basic move, which is to say, look, this high-speed internet access is just like a sidewalk. It makes possible a flourishing private market in services, for healthcare, for education, for media. That sidewalk shouldn't be controlled by a handful of players who can again decide, you know, on what terms people succeed or fail as they walk along. So the president is saying we need open internet access. It needs to be ubiquitous. It needs to be cheap. This is just like what FDR did with electricity in the 30s. And it's a big move, and it's a big series of moves, and it's exciting to see the president taking it on.
Now, you're obviously behind what the president is doing here. Is he going far enough, do you think?
He's doing what he can do without talking to Congress. He's got the most do-nothing, you know, Congress in the world. I've never seen anything like it. 20 years ago, Republicans would have agreed about all these issues. Trent Lott from Mississippi said it would be great to have municipal fiber. Actually, wouldn't have been talking about fiber at that point, but talking about municipal networks as competition to established incumbents. Today, the Republicans are all lined up against anything President Obama suggests, and so that's why he's using all of his executive powers to the fullest extent to open up these markets and ensure that Internet access is available to everyone at a reasonable price.
Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks so much for your interest in this issue. It's a big civil social justice issue for the country.
That was law professor Susan Crawford, author of Captive Audience, the Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age.
How do we find happiness and live the good life? Our next guest looked at cultures around the globe for lessons. He found that it isn't just about the personal choices we make. He says there are ways to set up our society and our public policy to make happiness more accessible for everyone.
Ted Fisher is with us now. He's professor of anthropology and director of the Center for Latin American Studies at Vanderbilt University. His new book is The Good Life: Aspiration, Dignity, and the Anthropology of Well-Being. Ted, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's a real pleasure to be here, Rob.
Well, a lot of your work and writing focuses on Germany and Guatemala. Are there common themes in, you know, defining the good life between first world consumers and Mayan coffee growers?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we all want to live the good life, whoever we are. If we're Mayan farmers in the highlands of Guatemala, if we're middle class supermarket consumers, we would all like to live the good life. But the trick is, we differ greatly in what that means and how best to get there. And in fact, you know, sometimes we differ violently, as events in Paris and the Middle East show us.
So how important? A lot of times people just think, you know, money, material stuff have got to be a key part of this. How important are they?
They're important up to an extent, but it's probably a lesser extent than most people think. We need to have enough money to get by. And again, enough varies from culture to culture and from context to context. But we need enough. Over enough, money doesn't help us very much. Actually, what's more important are things like relationships, experiences. We would all like to make a little more money. I would like to make more money. I'd like to have a little better car, a little bigger house. But if we pin all of our hopes to things like that, I think it's ultimately disappointing.
Now, before we get into some of the individual things that make a life good or, you know, more good or less good, a lot of times when we read books about happiness, it's presented as an individual thing. Here are the things you can do. Here are the decisions you can make. You're writing, and in your conclusions, you talk about lessons for a bigger picture, for public policy, for society as a whole, for setting people up for happiness.
Yeah, absolutely. Our happiness depends on the happiness of people around us, or the well-being of people around us. And I guess I should say here that we make a distinction between happiness, sort of everyday giddy happiness, the way we use the term in the U.S. Are you happy right now? And could I ask you that, Rob? Are you happy right now?
Yeah, I'm reasonably content, I'd say. I'm doing something I like to do, talking to people about stuff.
And that's what most people around the world would say. Even impoverished slum dwellers in Bombay would tell us that they're relatively happy right now. But if we ask people, looking back over the course of your whole life, and if you could put this on a ladder, and one being the worst life you could imagine and 10 being the best life possible, where would you put yourself on that scale? And many people, they would say that they're happy right now in the moment, but if you look at your whole life, they're less content. And so we make a distinction between happiness and well-being.
Well, let's get into the things that determine well-being. And you lay out a number of things that you find, again, talking to consumers in Germany, talking to Mayan coffee growers. And one of the ones you say is aspiration, the looking for some kind of improvement in the future. Why is that important?
Well, I think it's something inherent to human nature, that we aspire to something more, that we think that there's something better out there that we would like to achieve. Now, the trick and the reason why this isn't just sort of a personal issue about happiness is that we need structures that allow us the opportunity to realize those aspirations. And if we don't have those kind of structures in place, we get really frustrated. So I think we all aspire to something better, but is there a way to get there?
Does this have to be a material thing? We want to be paid a little more. We want, I don't know, whatever the Mayan coffee growers want, a little better prosperity. Or can it be more abstract or a moral condition?
Absolutely. In Germany, for example, if you ask supermarket consumers, why do you buy organic milk? Why do you buy fair trade coffee? They'll say, because I want to support a sense of social solidarity in my country. I want to know that the people at the other end of this commodity chain are doing okay. And that's really a moral vision. And it's something that, you know, we probably wouldn't hear in the States, this I'm buying what I buy because of social solidarity. And yet we do sometimes, you know, put our money where our morals are and buy fair trade items, for example. And that's really us voting for a certain kind of moral world that we would like to see.
And that's kind of a subtext of your book, challenging a notion from economics or from some economists anyway, of us as rational economic beings solely weighing some kind of cost and benefit without the moral factor, without the ethical calculations.
Absolutely. And every time we make an economic decision, it's actually a deeply moral decision as well. And that could be a morality of thriftiness as well as of generosity or cooperation. But nonetheless, yeah, too often my economics colleagues forget that we are deeply moral beings. And maybe if we allowed ourselves to embrace that a little bit more, it would free us up to make decisions in ways that could benefit everyone a little bit more.
Now, how would we draw this lesson here in the United States in our daily lives or maybe yearly lives?
Well, that's a good question. And it might paradoxically involve reducing choice sometimes. So, for example, I just got back last night from Copenhagen, and I went to the grocery store in Copenhagen, and there were two kinds of yogurt available. Now, if I went to the grocery store here in Nashville, I would probably have, you know, 15 different brands of yogurt and 30 different flavors of that yogurt, just sort of this overwhelming amount of choice, which seems like it would benefit my well-being, right? But in Denmark, you have fewer choices. The prices are higher, I'll grant you that. But the quality is also much higher. And the people who are working making those products are treated in a much better way. And so by reducing choice, you can actually sort of help create conditions that create a more just society, I would say.
And you mentioned being treated in a better way. And that's another one of the conditions you point to toward enhancing our well-being is having a feeling of dignity. How does that play out?
Absolutely. I think that a sense of dignity is, again, fundamental to our sense of self-worth and of well-being. And I think too often in our current economy, for example, with the rise of service sector jobs, and we've seen lots of economic inequality over the last decades, it's become in some ways an economy of haves and have-nots. And I fear that at the bottom end of that spectrum, we have a lot of jobs with less dignity than they used to. And again, to give you an example from Europe, my brother-in-law is a bike mechanic in Berlin. And he had to go through several years of training to become a bike mechanic. And he studied material science and physics and, you know, all of these different aspects that go into making a bike. And when you go into his bike shop and you ask him something about your bike, you're getting advice from a professional, from somebody who you can treat as an equal, right? And I feel like here a lot of times when we get service work like that done, we're dealing with somebody who has not had much training, has just been hired off the street, doesn't have much investment in it. And I think that there's not as much dignity in those jobs here.
Well, let's go back to Guatemala. You're working in some cases with people at the lower end of the economic and social spectrum there. Were there people who had more of a sense of dignity in what they did, and where did that come from?
Absolutely. So farmers especially, there's a sense that working the land is a virtuous profession or vocation. And so there was a real sense of producing food, provisioning food for other people. This is a job with a moral grounding in it. And so there was a real sense of pride and also a sense of bettering themselves. The Mayan farmers, I mean, they don't want their kids to be Mayan farmers. They would like for them to grow up and to go to school and, you know, maybe open a store, maybe even be a professional in their wildest dreams. And so there are material aspirations involved in this, but there's a moral component that underlies it all.
And finally, you talk about purpose and a sense of conviction, and it sounds like that's there among these farmers. How can we translate that into your average, say, service sector job here in the United States?
Well, that's a good question. And the high-tech companies have done a really good job of doing this, of having a sense of we're changing the world at Amazon or Google or wherever it may be. And part of that is empowering workers to make real decisions. It can make jobs more meaningful that way. But also a sense that the enterprise that I'm involved in, it's doing something important in the world. If I am making plywood, for example, but I'm doing it in a way that allows people to build homes that are more ecologically conscientious and more economical. So a sense of tying what we do to a larger purpose that goes beyond just pulling down a paycheck every month. You and I are very fortunate to have jobs where we're able to have that sense of purpose. But I think that we could also look for ways of endowing that sense of purpose in other kinds of jobs as well.
Well, that's an interesting start to a conversation. Ted, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's anthropologist Ted Fisher from Vanderbilt University. We've been talking about his new book. It's called The Good Life: Aspiration, Dignity, and the Anthropology of Well-Being.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Picture this scene. You go to a diner or a bar, and you know pretty much everyone there, and they know you. You know, you can just show up, no premeditation or planning, and find a community of people to hang out with. Maybe even yell out your name, like in the 80s sitcom Cheers, when Norm walks in.
Our next guest says that that type of community meeting space used to be the norm, but it's been dying a long, slow death, and nothing has really emerged to take its place. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have that kind of place today, where everybody knows your name and you can count on going there to have good conversations? What do you think we're missing out on? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Dean Barker joins us now. He's editor at Gadgetopia and director of business development at Blend Interactive. His piece on the death of the American watering hole was on boingboing.com. We've got it linked, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page. Dean, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So paint us a picture of what the classic watering hole might work like.
Well, you know, I think it's been popularized. I'm 43, right? So I was a child of the 80s, and I think it's really been popularized by sitcoms. I think that most sitcoms had that kind of central watering hole where people would gather, and it was a place really just ripe for situation comedy, so it was a really, really great script device. The piece that I wrote, I originally wrote as kind of an homage to a great book by a guy named Ray Oldenburg. Ray Oldenburg is a professor emeritus at the University of Western Florida, and he was in the sociology department, and he had written a book called The Great Good Place, which was about what he called the third place. Everybody has home and everybody has work, but we don't have this third place that we can go to. And he described in there this place that I immediately hit on as kind of the setting for most of the action in the sitcoms that I grew up with. And the idea that Oldenburg put forth is that there was some kind of neutral place that existed for conversation and was accessible, and it had a group of regulars that met there, and was a place that you could relax away from the stress of home or the stress of work and kind of collaborate and communicate with people. And I think that's really in decline across the country, and there are a number of different reasons for that. But
it seems like that kind of place that you just described existed pretty well in the 40s, the 50s. But in recent times, did we really have third places that functioned like that, you know, with the exception of TV?
You know, I think that we probably did up until the 80s and the 90s. But like I put forth in the piece, I think that the decline of the third place has really corresponded with the rise of the Internet and the rise of social networking in particular. I think in large part that has really killed the third place. We don't necessarily go to a physical place to interact with physical people anymore. We simply go online. We've developed online communities that have really become proxies for physical places we used to go to.
Well, I think we still have bars, obviously, lots of them here in Wisconsin. We've got coffee shops, lots of them in some areas. But you're making the case, I think, that they're not doing the same job. Why is it? Is it because we, you know, when we go to these places, if we're meeting people, we've planned it, we're not just seeing who's there?
Yeah, I think that's really it. You know, you bring up the coffee shop, and I mentioned the coffee shop in the piece. I don't know about you, but I don't really go to a coffee shop and identify with regulars there. If you go to a coffee shop now, everybody tends to be heads down in their screens working. And I'm reminded just last month, I have a 13-year-old daughter, and she had a birthday party. And I thought, oh, it was going to be crazy. There's going to be little girls bouncing off the walls. And it was very quiet downstairs. And so I went down into the basement, and I was confronted with four 13-year-old girls all staring into four separate screens. And I mean, this is really what it's become. And if you go into a coffee shop, being in a coffee shop without some kind of electronic device is a little weird. I mean, what would you be doing? Just sitting there drinking coffee, staring at the wall? I mean, who does that? And I think we've come full circle where it used to be odd if you were to go in there and you would isolate yourself in some kind of device. Now I think it's odd if you go in there and you don't.
What are we trading there? When we go online, we go to the coffee shop, we go on our device, and maybe we're on Facebook or something where we are having a kind of conversation versus just going in and talking to people. What's the trade-off?
You know, I've written before on the idea of asynchronous communication, and I think asynchronous communication, the idea of communication where you say something in some kind of online medium, and then I go away and give it some thought, and I form a response, and we have this kind of asynchronous communication. I think it's very valuable in a business and professional sense, but it's not nearly as spontaneous as face-to-face communication. And I think we lose something in spontaneity and passion. I mean, if you and I are going face-to-face and having an argument about something, I think it's a much, much different dynamic than if we have this kind of cold, calculating war of the keyboards. So to speak. I was talking to a college president that I know, and I think this is paralleled by the rise of online education, which I'm certainly not against, and there's absolutely a place for online education. But at the same time, I remember being in a college class. I was a political science major back in the 90s. I remember being in a class, and one of my professors, his method of teaching was to throw out an inflammatory statement and just let us argue about it back and forth. And it was wonderful, and it was very, very foundational for my skills as a communicator and skills I later developed as a professional. And you really lose that. And the New York Times did an article on online education. They said the student that's really attracted to online education in many cases is the student that really needs to be in a classroom and really needs to be arguing with people and going face-to-face and developing these communication and real-time analytical skills, which I think we lose to some extent.
We hear sometimes about a great sort going on in American culture where we voluntarily segregate ourselves, surround ourselves with people of the same opinions as us, people we hang out with, people we're online with. Would these watering holes be a solution to that? It's whoever shows up and you're talking to the regulars there and maybe you'll meet people radically different than yourself?
Oh, I think so. You're really preaching to the choir here. Because one of my favorite books of the last few years has been a book called The Filter Bubble. And it was written by a guy who started MoveOn. Eli is his first name. His last name escapes me. But he wrote this wonderful book called The Filter Bubble. And he says the Internet is such a unique communication medium in that it's not like radio, where radio just goes out as is to everybody. The Internet is intelligent and can form, fit, and adapt the information it communicates to you based on your behavior. And we're all starting to live in filter bubbles now. We've configured the Internet in such a way that it tells us what we like to hear. And he talked about Facebook's newsfeed. You know, I'm a Democrat, and if I have a bunch of liberal friends on Facebook and I click on their links, I'm probably going to start to see more liberal things appear in my Facebook feed because Facebook says, well, this is the thing that he likes, and we want to make him happy, so we're going to feed him these things. And there's all sorts of, you know, Google. If you Google for something and I Google for the exact same term, we might get different results because Google is going to cater the results to what it knows about us. And so we're living in these filter bubbles where the information we receive from the Internet is filtered just to the information that makes us happy. And I think that when you real-time communication, it's kind of the roll of the dice. You take what you get, and you may sit down with somebody who has vastly different opinions than you. My son is in college. He's a sophomore in college now, and he wanted to move home. And I told him, I said, I'm against you moving home. I want you to go live in a confined space with people you may not agree with. I want you to learn how to get along with people, learn how to argue with people, learn how to have a conversation with somebody and still respect their position and respect them as a person. I think there's huge interpersonal skills that you develop by being thrown into close quarters with people. And again, we're losing that by taking the discussion online and configuring the communication medium in such a way that it basically tells us what we want to hear.
What about the actual third space that's been lost, the coffee shop, the bar, the diner? Does not having an outside place that's not work, that's not home. I mean, aside from the people who are there, does not having that place away from home and work matter at all, the physicality of it?
I think so. I don't know about you, but I tend to get cabin fever. I live in the upper Midwest, and we get snowed in. I tend to get cabin fever. But I think getting away from the confines that you occupy most of your physical space is very, very helpful. There's an effect in Peter Trucker talked about this effect. I can't remember what the name of it was, but it says if you change the physical environment somebody's in, their productivity will go up. And they measured this by factory workers where they changed the brightness of the lights. And as they changed the brightness of the lights, whether they changed them up or they changed them down, after they were at a certain level for a while, productivity would tend to go up, and then it would eventually settle down. I think there's a place for variety in your physical surroundings. And an interesting sidelight to this is that I think this is paralleled by the rise in telecommuting. You have people that have gone from three places to two places because we lost our third place, and then some people are now telecommuting, so they've even lost that second place. So we have people that really fundamentally just have one place. And how would that affect somebody personality-wise, and how long would it take us to kind of notice those effects on society as a whole?
Let's go to a caller now. We've got Nick on the line in Madison. Nick, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, nice to speak with you. So I kind of have this, I don't know if I would call it a unique standpoint. I mean, obviously, being in Madison, there are a bunch of students, and what I found when I was a student is that if I went to some places like a coffee shop, it was specifically to get work done. I wasn't there to communicate with people necessarily. I was going to be facing a computer screen or in a book, and I kind of feel that everybody else there was in the same position. So I could either do that at home or I could do that in a coffee shop, but I always still felt the need to leave my house. Whether that be the cabin fever thing, and I think that's very much it. I tend to get very anxious if I'm at home all day and I haven't left and at least been in a place where other people are communing, not necessarily communicating, but being, and I tend to get more work done in situations like that, I guess because it made me concentrate on what I was doing instead of just saying, oh, I don't need to do this. I can do laundry also, or, you know, something like that.
Gotcha, Nick. Thanks a lot for the call. So, Dean, that's kind of that change of environment you're talking about. It reminds me of when my kids were little and there was parallel play. Like, it was valuable for kids to play near each other, even though they didn't play with each other. Is that, do we get at least something out of being isolated in an environment with other isolated people?
You know, I don't know. That'd be interesting. That'd be interesting to pursue. But I thought it was really interesting what Nick said about, you know, I plan to go to this place to get work done. So, I mean, this is what we've become. We go to a place with other people in order to get work done. I mean, is it enough for us to just be in close physical proximity to other humans? I think there is some benefit to that. But we used to go to places where other people were so we would talk to them. And we used to go to these places to have communication with people. When we wanted to get work done, we would go away from these people and sit alone. And now we've kind of flipped it. And there's some people who can't work anymore when they're alone. They need to go to some place where it has some noise and there's some people milling about. And I think that's very, very interesting how society today has flipped that.
We're talking right now with Dean Barker about the death of the American watering hole and the loss of that third space. It's different from work and different from home, where communities gather and you can just show up and see people you know without making plans in advance.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Do you have a place like this, or did you used to? Do you wish you did? Does social media fill the void, or do we need to be there in person? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We continue our conversation with Dean Barker about his piece, The Long, Slow Death of Our Watering Holes. He says that we've lost those community spaces, diners and taverns, among others, where people gather outside the home and work, where there's a built-in community of people. We know them and they know us.
You can join in if you have a spot like this or wish you did. 800-642-1234, or you can post over at the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right back to our callers. We've got Megan on the line in Green Bay. Megan, hi.
Hi, I just had the point that I'm 27 years old, and I feel that I'm the last person under, what, like maybe 40 now, who doesn't have a smartphone. and also that I work at a bar, which could be one of those third places that we're talking about here, and I see even when groups of coworkers might come out to eat or get a drink after work or when friends come out, there's a group of five people, and they sit together. Like the last caller said, they just want to be near each other, but everyone has a screen in front of their face, and I think it's kind of eerie and creepy that people would rather be on this invisible social internet space than being comfortable making eye contact in that small chit-chat face-to-face.
Wow, Megan, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Dean, do you think there'd be room if, a bar or diner or something said, hey, this is a screen-free environment, this is a place where you have to come and interact with other humans?
So in the article, I approached that. I said, I'm going to launch Kickstarter for a bar that has no Wi-Fi. And then someone tweeted me after the piece that went live. They tweeted me and said, this exists. And there's a bar somewhere, a coffee shop somewhere that has a sign that says, if you ask for the Wi-Fi password, we'll throw you out. and so this exists. This is a place. But when she was saying, the caller was saying that she's the only one she knows that doesn't have a smartphone, there's a really great photo essay online. It's called The Death of Conversation. And if you Google for The Death of Conversation, it'll be the top hit. A guy took this photo essay. He just took pictures of people sitting in locations, like waiting, like sitting on a bus or whatever, staring into individual smartphones. And it's really kind of tragic when you look at it. And when you compare it to the title, A Death of Conversation, these are people who used to be talking to each other. And it's really interesting to scroll through these pictures and these people just sitting there staring into screens, like my daughter and her friends at her birthday party. This is when people used to be having conversations, and I feel incredibly hypocritical even talking about it because I absolutely do it. My smartphone is an escape from boredom. We've become afraid of silence to the point where, and I'll be on my smartphone, I'll not be doing anything intelligent. I'll be scrolling through icons of apps trying to find an app that will give me some kind of, narcotic hit of amusement.
Yeah, thank you for being honest. I do the same thing, and I hate myself afterwards, but I still do it. I don't know. I'm trying to decouple. But one thing real quick before we go back to the callers that struck me about that call was eye contact. Do you think people are getting less comfortable with meeting another person's eyes to talk?
That absolutely could be. I think our social skills are just gradually regressing all over. We're to the point that we think sitting there doing nothing is just kind of weird. I mean, we don't want to look stupid to sit there doing nothing, so we pull out our smartphone to kind of hide behind that thing, because the idea of sitting there doing nothing and like vaguely contemplating our position in the universe is considered strange, and we don't want to be the odd man out, so we need to find some amusement, I guess.
Let's go back to our callers. Charles is on the line in Toma. Charles, hi.
Hi. This is an interesting topic. What I was wondering is, if you looked at also the collapse of this third spot for people to go to, is also the collapse in the middle class, where people used to be on bowling teams or social societies, and instead they're worried about, having two jobs or things of that nature and not feeling stable in where they are in their place in society. Besides that other caller mentioned, I heard someone say before, the coach, I think, of the Milwaukee Brewers said that this is a head-down generation.
Charles, thanks a lot for that call. I want to get Dean Barker in on this. We're uncertain, insecure economically, so we're not joiners anymore, not getting out and interacting.
I absolutely did not think of that when I wrote the piece, but when it was published on Boing Boing, and for every article Boing Boing publishes, they have a companion comment thread and discussion forum, and that was one of the first things that came up. And this was absolutely not in my head at all when I wrote it. But the first thing that came up was this: we don't have time to do this. We don't have disposable income. We don't have time anymore. And this is why these things have collapsed. The idea of going home and just kind of hanging out at a bar just wouldn't occur to us anymore because we're too busy working our second job or something like that. So I didn't think of that, but the caller certainly was not the first one to come up with that association.
Thanks a lot for the call, Charles. We go next to Carol in Madison. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I think that the previous caller has a really good point. However, I do think there is somewhat of a third place in knitting stores, particularly ones that have coffee shops with them. I know that I could go into a half a dozen yarn stores in the area, and there would always be people there I knew. Not just people who work there, but people who are there.
Huh.
Okay, you interesting, know, Carol. So people gathering around a particular interest, maybe, you know, there's that in common. What do you think about people gathering by interest like knitting, Dean?
Okay, well, I'm going to say something potentially inflammatory, and I apologize to Carol in advance, but I would say there might be a cause and effect here, because the people who gather in knitting stores might well be of the generation prior to the Internet. Knitting stores in particular, I'd say there may be an age factor there, that you're going to look at people who are probably a bit older than the average, and they're probably much more used. They come from a generation where we had these watering holes. But I absolutely do think if you group around some kind of hobby, I mean, clearly there's going to be more conversation. And that's what we found with coffee shops these days, is that you don't know if you have anything in common with the people around you. I mean, how would you even start a conversation with them? So that could be.
As we wrap up, Dean, do you see any hope for a return of the watering hole to its classic era, or like we used to see on TV?
I'm sorry, but I don't. I wish I could be more positive. But given the way things are going with mobile technology, I just don't see it going back to the way it was before. And on one hand, that's tragic, but I think as a society, it's our responsibility to forge a new path and to find some happy medium between the way things are and some kind of positive advantages of that. So I think there will be a new normal, and I think it's our responsibility to make sure it's a positive normal, not a negative one.
All right, Dean, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's Dean Barker, editor at Gadgetopia and director of business development at Blend Interactive. If you head over to the Central Time Facebook page, we've got a link to his full piece. You can read it there. And on the Central Time Facebook page, you can share your thoughts on the death of the American watering hole. Make sure you're entering it while you're looking at your phone. In a public place, maybe at the coffee shop or the diner, or maybe strike up a conversation while you're there and tell us how it went. I got some news a little late yesterday. Last month saw the passing of the creator of two movie and TV icons, two of the best-known fictional robots ever seen on a screen. I saw a link to his obituary posted this weekend on George R. R. Martin's website.
Robert Kinoshita was the designer of Robbie the Robot, famous for its appearance in Forbidden Planet, among other movies and TV shows, and the robot from the legendary TV show Lost in Space.
The robot's catchphrase lives on.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger. No, Will Robinson. Danger.
Bit of a downer, that robot.
It's always the danger.
He was a great robot, though. Yeah. And Kinoshita's early movie career as an art and production designer was interrupted when he was forced to live in a Japanese-American internment camp during World War II. He restarted his career after the war and was later inducted into the Robot Hall of Fame.
Now, when I saw that note, definitely a personal effect. Robbie the Robot, my namesake. I went by Robbie all the way through high school, really. So I always felt a connection to Robbie the Robot, more so than the Lost in Space robot. What's a favorite movie and TV robots? Any thoughts?
You gotta love C-3PO and R2, yeah. And of course the Dalek. They're kind of annoying, but you love them anyway.
Yeah, they're hard. It's hard to watch Doctor Who with Daleks if people are in the background just hearing the screeching Dalek voice, though.